Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
This is BusinessWise. Our guest today is David Main. David is the president and the CEO of the Hamilton County Development Company, which, David, you started about 30 years ago. This is your 30th year anniversary.
That's correct. It's coming up April 11th, 1983 is when we actually got the ball rolling.
It's amazing. And then in 1989, you developed the Hamilton County Business Center, which is a small business incubator that has generated hundreds and hundreds of jobs for our region.
We have over 286 companies go through the program. We have roughly 134 graduates that are still in business after 5 years of graduation from the program.
How many clients do you have currently in there?
There are currently 46 companies in the center. In 2012, they generated almost $20 million in aggregate revenues. They employed over 220 people. Their payrolls were almost $12 million.
So, David, let's tell folks who may not be familiar with the Hamilton County Development Company. I mean, it is a great example of a public-private partnership that really has such reaching impact to our entire region.
Hamilton County Development Company is really three things. First of all, where we got our start was with the Small Business Administration Certified Development Company, also known as 504 Loan Program. And that's how we commenced operations back in 1983, where we make small business loans to companies that are growing, expanding, need to acquire real estate or other fixed assets. From then, we expanded into the Business Incubation Program in order to make the core of Hamilton County a hotbed of entrepreneurial activity. Now, you mentioned in 1989 where we got our start. One of the genesis behind it was the closing of a number of manufacturers in the core Hamilton County, including the General Motors Assembly Plant that made Camaros and Firebirds. We were able to obtain a small grant from the Department of Commerce Economic Development Administration, some support from the county, the state of Ohio, in order to acquire this building, renovate it, and eventually acquire the property across the street in the mid-90s.
So, David, I can remember the day. I was on one of the original board, I think, even before you bought the building for the Hamilton County Business Center.
You were chair.
I was chair. Can you believe that? A long time ago. And I remember going through that building before anything had been done to it. It's just amazing how fast forward, what an impact that whole organization, I mean, you have just done an amazing job in really transforming what entrepreneurship is here in our region.
Well, the operations have changed somewhat, well, more than somewhat. For example, when we came in there, the idea was to have a very bare bones basic facility. If you didn't like the color of the paint, you painted the walls. It would be a bare light bulb. Mm-hmm. But with the changes in entrepreneurs, where maybe it's not Class A space, but it's definitely has to be Class C or up to date, we've had to make improvements in amenities. Cleaning up, putting in streetscaping, cleaning the brick, modernizing the lobby. In fact, we've just recently done that, adding some flat-screen TVs to the lobby and promoting that.
I would imagine the mix of your tenants has changed over the years, too. 30 years ago, there weren't too many technology companies around here. I suspect you have quite a few in the incubator now.
Of the 46, roughly 80% are technology-based, or we would call them innovative and scalable. The specialty seems to be measurement technologies, and this is some of it comes out of the University of Cincinnati College of Engineering, plus GE has produced some of our more successful graduates. We wanted to come up with a reasoned response to the decline of manufacturing, and we felt by making that a hotbed of entrepreneurial activity, it's more than just a building, though. We have to provide administrative support services. It's also an environment that's conducive to risk-taking and entrepreneurial thinking. And last, but certainly most important, ready access to business coaching and management advice.
David, if anyone listening would like to get in contact with you or learn more about the Hamilton County Development Company or the Business Center, what's your website?
Our website is HCDC, Hamilton County Development Company, or for the loans, HorizonsCertifiedDevelopmentCompany.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guest is David Main. David is the president and CEO of the Hamilton County Development Company. And David, a lot of people know about Hamilton County Development Company, particularly with regard to the incubator that you have in Norwood. But you have other facets of the organization that are just as important. You help a lot of companies get loans. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that part of your program.
HCDC administers the SBA, or Small Business Administration 504 loan program, through its certified development company. This program provides long-term, 10 or 20 years, financing at a fixed interest rate. Currently, the 20-year term is 4.12% and enables businesses to acquire fixed assets, primarily real estate, on occasion machinery and equipment. Over the years, HCDC has approved over $361 million worth of loans and has financed nearly $1 billion worth of projects. Now, we make these loans not only in Hamilton County, but throughout the state of Ohio and the Commonwealth of Kentucky. But being a certified development company has also helped establish a culture at HCDC. And what I mean by that is we had to actually go out and market and find prospects, qualify them not only for credit underwriting, but also eligibility for SBA financing, then process them through our own approval process, submit them, package them to the SBA. Once they're approved, close and fund, and lately, particularly with the recession, service these loans.
Who would be the primary candidates for your loans?
We're looking for businesses that need to expand, they need to acquire real estate, need to buy a bigger building, maybe they even need to buy the facility they're leasing. Companies that are looking to expand, they have to have a net worth of less than $15 million, profits after taxes of under $8 million. If they exceed those, there's another way to qualify them under the regular SBA program.
So this is really for small businesses?
Correct. Small for-profit businesses. Almost any type of for-profit business will qualify. There are a few notable exceptions. We cannot do nonprofits, and there are a few others that are ineligible.
And David, I think a lot of people over the years have equated small business loans, SBA loans, with those that have more strings attached. Is that true?
There are probably a few more strings from the standpoint that it's not enough for a business merely to be eligible on credit-wise. They need to show an extrinsic benefit. What I mean by that is they need to demonstrate that they are going to either retain or, more importantly, create new jobs. One job for $65,000 of SBA loan money, which is 40% of a project, or up to 40% of a project, or in the case of a manufacturer, up $100,000. They can also qualify as under what's considered a national objective. It can be an exporter, it can be a minority business, or it can be facilitating community benefit. For example, locating in an enterprise zone or diversifying a local economy. We've been involved with doing some small restaurants in neighborhood business districts that were part of the revitalization strategy.
Mm-hmm. And so for people who don't understand, you mentioned 40%, and that's because effectively they're still borrowing their money from a bank. It's just the SBA, the Small Business Administration, is guaranteeing 40%.
That's correct. The structures, they really have two loans. They have a 50% first mortgage from a bank, private lender, normally it's a bank. They have 40% from HCDC. We take a second mortgage, and then they're required to put up 10%. In some cases, if it's a startup business, they need to put an additional 5% down, or if it's a single-purpose building, they may have to put another 5% down. But the typical structure is 50-40-10.
And if folks listening today would like to get more information about those loans or about Hamilton County Development Company, your website is?
HCDC.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, well, January's come and gone, and even though we're at the beginning of the year, many people have already broken their New Year's resolutions.
Well, Crystal, hopefully you're not looking at me when you're saying that and talking about my waistline.
No, I'm not, actually. You've been very good all year so far. But I am talking about the fact that only 8% of people report that they've kept their resolutions a year later, which understandably leads one to wonder, why bother with resolutions at all?
Well, for 92%, maybe they shouldn't. But do you think maybe the problem is one of two things? Either they have too many resolutions and they can't decide which ones to keep, or their goals are too lofty and they're not achievable.
Yes, I think people just try to accomplish too much. So it's a much better idea to really prioritize what's important to you and really focus on achieving those goals. Actually vision yourself achieving that goal. And one of the things to do, even though we've already into February, start now. Don't wait till next January to come up with a new resolution. Think now about what you'd yet like to accomplish in 2013.
Yeah, for instance, your goal might be to be financially independent by the time you retire so that you'll have enough money to live the way you want to in retirement. Well, you probably can't get there in 12 months, but maybe there's a 12-month goal like increase your 401k contribution by some amount of money. That's pretty achievable.
Yes, and you know, we always talk about the fact that it's an idea is just an idea unless it's written down. A goal really needs to be written down. And so if you're looking into the long term, just like you were discussing, think about incremental steps along the way. Certainly, make sure that you do have that written down in a plan that's actually attainable. It's okay to stretch a little. Just make sure that you're able to achieve success with whatever goal you're trying to accomplish.
You know, I think another secret to achieving your resolutions is to communicate your goal to other people. So you get a little bit of peer pressure to accomplish the goal. Don't just keep it to yourself. Tell people what your goals are.
I agree. Just being held accountable many times will help you stay on course of achieving that goal. And, you know, again, so many people focus on the fact that maybe they did have a goal that has slipped by, a resolution that they've not kept. Don't worry about what's happened in the past. You need to really think about going forward. What you failed to accomplish already this year is a sunk cost. Think about what you're going to do to achieve your goal. And, you know, I heard a great story of someone telling me what they do, the way they actually keep their goals in top of mind all year, is they write them down and then they either put them in a picture frame and put them all over their house, and others just laminate. Just someplace where they can actually see those goals every day. That is a very big incremental factor in making sure people achieve success.
Well, and sometimes you have to have mileposts along the way. So maybe your goal is to save $10,000, but you need to do it in steps. So maybe you should have a goal for the end of February, one for the end of April, to make sure that you're measuring your progress and starting to achieve it.
And, you know, I've also heard people build little incentives in along the way. So when you reach one milestone, reward yourself. Also, people put a penalty. So another option might be, if you fail to keep a goal or if you get off track a little bit, make a commitment that perhaps you're going to contribute money to a charity, which is still a good thing to do, even if you fail to keep the specific goal.
The key, I think, is to have your goals, write them down, monitor your progress, and hopefully at the end of the year, you'll be proud that you were able to achieve some of those goals.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, well, we're starting to see some of the tax forms arrive in the mail or in our inbox in terms of tax reporting.
But there's still a few things people can do to affect last year's taxes, even though last year is officially over.
One of the big things that people can do that can actually save them tax money if they can qualify is contribute to an individual retirement account.
Depending on your age, you can put up to $6,000, $5,000 for a normal contribution, and you get another $1,000 if you're over age 50.
And you have until the tax deadline, April 15th this year, to contribute the money and yet get the deduction on your 2012 return.
But of course, it's not always that simple. You may not be able to deduct your contribution to your IRA, depending on whether or not you're covered by another retirement plan and your income level. You may only be able to contribute to a non-deductible IRA. If that's the case, depending on your income, you may want to consider contributing to a Roth IRA. The benefit of a Roth is you don't get any deduction when you put the money in, but you don't have to pay tax when you take the money out as long as it stays there for a long enough period of time.
And the other thing some people can do is go ahead and contribute to a non-deductible IRA if it's not deductible because of the things you just mentioned, and then convert the non-deductible IRA to a Roth IRA. Of course, there's all kinds of issues that you have to contend with. It's not a good idea, perhaps, if people have other IRAs. There's some issues there, but clearly it's something worth considering.
Another good idea for people who have already funded their IRA, fund your 2013 IRA early in the year. That way you get more benefit out of the deferral of tax. Really, whether it's a deductible or a non-deductible or a Roth IRA, it's still more beneficial to have the money earn income within the IRA account where it's not currently taxed.
The earlier you get the money in, the more the investment earnings grow on a tax-deferred or in a Roth case, a tax-free basis, assuming that they can qualify for the Roth. So if you can qualify for a Roth IRA, it's an amazing thing to take advantage of.
Well, it can be, especially if you're going to be in the same or a higher tax bracket in retirement than what you are currently. And the way the tax laws look like they're heading, there's going to be a greater number of the population that will be in those higher tax brackets.
And you know, Tom, I wish Roth IRAs were around when I was growing up, because I think one of the big gifts a parent or a grandparent or anyone really can do to help a young person today is help them understand the benefit of a Roth IRA. So for example, when our kids work, we match a portion of what they earn and we put our match into a Roth IRA for their benefit. So again, if you're a parent and you do have a child that has worked, which is a great thing, then you can teach them that when they work for money, then maybe you can contribute some portion of that to a Roth IRA on their benefit.
And this year, for people contributing to 2013 accounts, you can even add another $500 to the maximum amount for an IRA contribution.
Again, the rules around IRAs are very confusing for many people. They're complicated because of all the exceptions and the income limitations and thresholds. So it's certainly something that you want to make sure that you understand and that you're taking full advantage of whatever type of IRA best suits your need. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Chris Finney. Chris is the president at the law firm of Finney, Stagnaro, Sabin, Patterson. And Chris, you focus a lot of your practice area in real estate, commercial, residential real estate. Are you seeing any more activity? Are things improving in that, and from your perspective?
A little bit to my surprise, given the unsettled environment in the economy, what appears to be in the economy generally and out of Washington, it appears that we've seen a market uptick in activity. I represent realtors, home builders, developers, and then also in the commercial side, investors. And across the board, there seems to be more optimism and more activity than we've seen in the last 48 months.
Are you seeing commercial properties, investors being able to obtain financing more easily than they were a year or two ago?
Yeah, there are really two factors, I think, that have contributed to the uptick of activity. One is at the end of last year, a lot of people wanted to conclude transactions to avoid what looked like an inevitable increase in effective tax rates. And guess what? We got a significant effective increase in tax rates, so those people were wise. But the other piece of that is that the commercial lenders have really turned around quite a bit. So if you went into the market 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, you literally couldn't borrow money. It didn't matter how well leveraged you were. It didn't matter how good the transaction was. The lenders did not want to lend.
They just didn't want that kind of business. They were actually purging that type of loan from their portfolio, even if you've never missed a payment.
That's right. It was actually, I can't say the first time in my career that I'd seen that, but a number of our clients sort of got a knock on the door from the bank. And instead of saying, hey, we'd like to lend you more money, they said, you know, all that money we've loaned you, we'd like you to pay it back right now. In an environment where you can't borrow it from anybody else. And they were calling loans and, in some cases, bankrupting companies who were perfectly solvent and making all their payments because the banks got overly conservative. And candidly, in my now 27 years, I've seen this with lenders where they'll swing from euphoric lending that is irrational, and then they swing the other way to incredible conservatism that's irrational. Ultimately, they swing back to the irrational, euphoric lending again. And I think now we're not, you know, to the euphoric lending stage. But the good news is really a double dose of good news. One is that rates are at historic lows. Well, really, triple dose of good news, because rates are at historic lows, number one. Number two, lenders are actually lending to ordinary people at those rates. So if you went in to try to refinance your business property, let's say 2 years ago, and they just said, we're not lending, go back today, because a lot of these banks are very anxious to lend money right now. And then the third thing that's kind of interesting is the Fed has pre-announced something that they've never done before, that they're going to keep these low rates for the foreseeable future. So for the next 24 to 36 months, you can expand your business, can invest in real estate, and have some degree of confidence that the rates aren't going to tick back up and the environment's going to change dramatically.
Chris, what do you think will happen with what may go on in Washington in the next few months with regard to the budget negotiations and spending? Do you think that's going to have an impact on real estate and local transactions here?
Of course, I'm not an economist and I'm not a prognosticator about this, but I heard an economist describe this as trying to hold a balloon or a ball underwater. You can hold it underwater so long, eventually you lose your grip, and boy, does it pop up right away. And I think that that's the effect we're seeing with interest rates. The Fed and the Congress are doing everything they can to keep interest rates suppressed, and that's resulting in the positive economic activity that I've described, and wiser men than me may know if that ends up being a good or bad thing.
Chris, if folks listening today would like to reach you, find out more about your information and your practice, what's your contact information?
It's Chris at chrisfinney.com, C-H-R-I-S at chrisfinney, F-I-N-N-E-Y.com.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Chris Finney. Finney is the president of the law firm of Finney, Stagnaro, Saab, and Patterson. And Chris, I know you focus a lot of your effort and your practice in real estate personally. And, you know, I live in an area in the middle of Cincinnati that I just feel like I'm seeing a lot more sold signs. Are you seeing that in terms of investment property and commercial property as well?
There's really a couple pieces to that. One is at the end of last year, when people anticipated a change in tax rates, there was a significant uptick in activity. But beyond that, I think some national surveys have shown that prices are firming up, the number of transactions is up, even new construction activity is back in some instances.
From an inventory standpoint, is that why? Is it because for a while there we had a lot of inventory for people to be able to either lease or buy? Now we're actually seeing that diminish?
Yes, and that's a very good thing for the marketplace. So for years we had, in all categories, in residential, in office space, retail space, and so on, an excess supply. And until that supply is used up, prices will be going to be depressed. It's going to put a lot of pressure on investors, owners, lenders for that. So you saw a lot of foreclosure activity. As soon as that oversupply goes away, prices immediately firm up and then eventually actually rise, which makes the financing and economics of real estate much better. Depending on the segment of the market, you're seeing more strength than otherwise. So the apartment market, for example, is very strong.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that because it still feels like that people may not be able to buy a home if they don't have great credit scores, if they don't have enough money to put down. So do you see investment in real estate for apartments and that type of thing continuing strong for a while?
I would say in 2012, my clients that had multifamily properties were the happiest of the bunch. They were buying, they were building, they were investing, and some were selling. They were very happy with the values that they were seeing. And the reason actually was a negative reason, which you described, which is a lot of people who had been in single-family homes, or they would be a traditional buyer who in past years would have gone into a single-family home, are just renting until the market firms up or until their credit scores firm up. Some of them don't qualify. And again, I think that's a good sign. The lenders in the residential marketplace have gone back more to fundamentals. This remarkable notion that we should only make home loans to people who can actually pay them back, for example.
Yes.
And so they're looking at the actuarial tables and saying, what kind of borrower with a down payment, with a good credit score, is likely to pay their loan back? And those are the kinds of people that they're lending to. As we move back to the fundamentals in the single family market, it has at least temporarily strengthened the rental market, and that's been a good thing. In terms of the fundamentals of the real estate market, at least on an interim basis until interest rates rise, things seem very strong.
For folks who are looking for investment properties right now, do you have any advice?
Well, the biggest piece is, you know, if you went out into the market to get loan money a few years ago and you wouldn't be eligible, you're eligible today. A lot of people are. Banks are really wanting to lend. Banks seem to be enthusiastic in a wise way, but to get back into the market, don't assume that the circumstance that existed even 6 or 9 months ago is the way it is today, because it's a much more friendly environment out there for people who want to get into the investment side or even into a single family home.
And your contact information is?
You can use my email address at chris@chrisfinney.com. Chrisfinney, or my office number is 513-533-2980.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Kate Keller. Kate is a senior program officer for the Health Foundation of Greater Cincinnati. And Kate, you know, insurance is something that impacts everyone, and a few years ago, we became aware that we're going to all be impacted by the Affordable Care Act. Many of those provisions have kicked in already, but for individuals, a lot of that's still to come.
Correct. Many of the provisions for private insurance have already taken place. So many of the benefit changes people have already seen in their insurance plans. However, next year in 2014, there will be a requirement for all of us to have insurance. So that's something to think about by the end of this year. You're going to have to be prepared to purchase insurance for 2014.
So there's nothing people should be doing now in terms of preparing for the transition that is going to occur in 2014.
Correct. I think right now, you know, you just need to be knowing that at the end of this year, maybe around October, you need to start looking into your options if you don't currently have insurance.
So this really applies to people who aren't covered by an employer plan at work, or they don't have their own private insurance.
Correct. So if you're someone who's not insured, or if you lose your job over this year and you lose your insurance, they'll be the people who will be most impacted by this. If you already have insurance from your employer, things will stay the same next year.
Well, what if you have insurance from your employer, but you're having to fund a great deal of it? Will you be able to opt out of that and then purchase the insurance through the exchange?
You sure can. I mean, there will be options available for people. There will be tax subsidies available on the exchange, but if you have employer-sponsored insurance, that tax subsidy is only available to you if your employer's insurance is not affordable. But you can still make the choice to buy it from the exchange or from your employer.
For many years, and actually really until now, insurance has been just this big ambiguous type of issue that most people just don't understand. It's not very transparent. The Affordable Health Care Act can actually change much of that.
Part of the role of the law was to make insurance more understandable and more transparent, and to make it easier to understand. So when you're looking at one type of plan, you can compare it to others. And insurance companies can no longer have sort of small print. It has to be very clear what they cover. And again, to make it easier for us to understand what we're purchasing.
And so do you foresee or predict that maybe these choices will be made online at a website?
Absolutely. If you're purchasing insurance through the Health Insurance Exchange, which will be available in October of this year, you will be purchasing it online like you would plane tickets. It is a very different model, but it should make it, since many of us are comfortable shopping online, it should make it easier for many of us to go and look and compare and shop insurance all at one time and make it easy. So you don't have to go from one company to the next company. You could do it in one place.
So, you know, Kate, it's fascinating to me because this Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, there's so much controversy over that.
I think there's a lot of controversy about a lot of parts in the law. The health insurance exchanges itself as an entity aren't that controversial. Many people believe having an online, easy-to-navigate system is a good way to go for purchasing insurance.
So some states are choosing to run their own exchanges. Ohio, for example, has made the decision not to. Kentucky will have its own exchange.
Correct.
What are the pros and cons for individuals who live in those states in terms of whether their state is running their own exchange or going to the government?
The individual probably won't see much of a difference, except maybe the insurance plans that are offered. So in a state that runs their own, like Kentucky, you may see Kentucky-only plans or insurance providers that are only in Kentucky. In a federally run exchange, you're going to see the big players. So you'll see plans from the big insurance companies.
What should someone listening be doing on a proactive basis to be better informed in October?
You know, I think you just need to keep aware that this change is coming, and that there'll be lots and lots of information coming out about what the insurance exchanges are at the end of summer. We have a website completely dedicated to the Affordable Care Act. It's reform.healthfoundation.org. There's all kinds of information there about the law.
Reform.healthfoundation.org. I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Kate Keller. Kate is the Senior Program Officer for the Health Foundation of Greater Cincinnati. And, you know, Kate, there's been so much discussion about health insurance. It impacts every one of us. This whole idea of exchanges, and what does that really mean, and how will that affect people? Maybe you can clear some of that up.
Sure. A health insurance exchange is going to be an online marketplace for insurance. And many people compare it to travel websites like Expedia, Orbitz, Travelocity. So you'll be able to go online, put in your information of how many people you want covered and where you live, and it will show you plans that are available to you. And you'll be able to pick different types of plans that meet your family's needs.
And then you'll be charged a going rate for those?
Well, the prices will be listed, so you'll be able to compare, you know, what one insurance company is offering for the same type of plan that another insurance company offers. The benefit from going through the exchange for many people is that tax subsidies are available for people who earn under 400% of the federal poverty level, which is about $90,000 for a family of four. If you purchase insurance on the exchange and you qualify for a subsidy, they will process that for you. So you'll be able to get more affordable insurance.
So in other words, you won't have to pay as much for a higher level of insurance.
Correct.
There's a lot of controversy about whether states will run their exchanges. Ohio is not running their exchange. Kentucky is. Maybe you can share those implications.
Sure. Each state was given a choice of whether or not they wanted to run their own exchange. They could have set up several exchanges in this state, or they could allow the federal government to run the exchange. And Ohio is actually going to do a shared partnership with the federal government. So Ohio will maintain control of some components of insurance, such as oversight of all the plans in the exchange. They will make sure that they meet state laws and that there's oversight there. They are also maintaining control of the Medicaid enrollment, which will also go through the exchange for people to come onto Medicaid. But the actual management of the plans will be run by the federal government. It really shouldn't be much different to the consumer.
Well, I think some people might give pause thinking the federal government's running their insurance program, right? But you say that...
Well, they're not running the insurance program. They're running the place where you're purchasing your insurance. So your insurance will still be run by the company. This is just the portal of where you will purchase your insurance.
So what's all the horror stories? I mean, this whole conversation about perhaps people won't be able to get procedures that they would otherwise be able to get on their own.
You know, I think a lot of that was just sort of political talk. And the law itself actually provides lots of protections for consumers around healthcare and expands the type of insurance that we all have to have. So while we're mandated to have insurance, we're mandated to have good insurance so that when you get sick, you will be covered.
There were a lot of folks who were not in favor of the Affordable Care Act. What was the big issue there that was so controversial?
Well, there were probably a lot of them, but having a mandate to purchase a private product of private health insurance is probably one of the biggest. I mean, I think there are just different philosophies behind those mandates.
Well, let's talk for a moment the difference between a private insurance exchange for the general public and one for small business.
Sure. Every state will have two exchanges, one for the individual and one for small businesses. And they have a choice to allow small businesses have 50 or fewer employers or 100. And it'll be a place where, of course, the small businesses can go shop for insurance. Again, compare insurance plans, and it'll be easier and faster and more transparent for them. And if they qualify for a tax subsidy, which many small businesses do, that can also be processed through the exchange.
Sure, there are credits available for small businesses that qualify.
Correct.
That provide insurance, but mm-hmm. You said the magic number is 50.
If you have less than 50 full-time employees, you do not have to provide insurance. You are exempt from the mandate to provide insurance. However, if you do, and you have fewer than 25 employees, then you may qualify for a tax subsidy. So if you choose to provide it, you may have some help there.
If folks listening today would like information, what's your website?
Our website is reform.healthfoundation.org.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Tom Cooney, and this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Linda Antis. Linda is the president and CEO of the Cincinnati USA Regional Tourism Network. And Linda, you recently had an economic impact study. What can you tell us about why your organization is so important to our community?
Absolutely. Many people don't necessarily think of our destination, our region, as a place that people go on a vacation or enjoy leisure traveling. And in fact, travel and tourism is a huge economic driver, typically in the United States and across the country. But in our region, it's a huge economic impactor. Many, many statistics that we needed to find to help our community understand how important travel and tourism is and the role that, for instance, your family plays in being a welcoming person to a visitor.
You know, it's like many places, you ignore all these wonderful things that we have to do around here because we're so used to them. But
That's
other people
right.
travel here just to see certain things, whether it be a sporting event, a cultural event.
Absolutely. You know, the economic impact study is very powerful because it shows you, first of all, that we're measured as a region. We're measured as 3 states and 15 counties throughout that area. And it measures all kinds of interesting sectors that you may not necessarily think of. You think of hotels, you think of restaurants, attractions, special events, and festivals. But it also measures transportation and the ensuing pieces of what a traveler will bring to our economy.
And what do they bring? Because there's a multiplier effect, isn't there, with every dollar they spend?
There certainly is. In fact, this study was conducted about 2011, and it showed that we generated $4.1 billion in revenue related to those sectors that are called travel and tourism. The extender on that gets us to $7.3 billion in terms of the direct and the induced spending that all of those people who visit us actually feed into the coffers of our 15 counties within the 3 states.
So that would include, I would assume, people travel to see the Reds, the Bengals, the zoo, the museum center, and all the other various attractions.
Absolutely. And not to mention, I mean, think about how proud we are of all the new development we have on both sides of the river between the banks and the whole Newport and the Covington upgrades that are now going to be going on. It's about development. It's about the tourism and travel business and the ensuing revenue and the tax benefit that provides.
Well, what was the real purpose of the study, besides knowing that it's been successful? What else did you hope to accomplish?
Well, our tourism industry, again, throughout the country, is one that oftentimes communities aren't really that clear on the impact that it brings to your tax and your revenue base. And so we conducted it because it's been a bit over a decade, I believe, since the last one was done. We wanted to understand where we stand. We also wanted to compare it to some of our past numbers to see if we're growing. And in fact, we are growing. It's like a cycle. So that information helps to inform developers who may choose to invest. It also helps our own communities understand, wow, I should get out and spend money, but I also should work with people like the Regional Tourism Network, use their website, CincinnatiUSA.com, to share with my friends and relatives out of town so that they come and visit, because look at the impact it creates for our community. There's a really interesting statistic that the study helped us bring it down to the level of what I understand when I go home, or that my mom and dad would understand. If tourism did not exist, the economic impact from the local and state taxes would mean that you and I would each have to pay $644 more each year in taxes out of our own pocket.
And if our listeners want to know what's going on, what's your website again?
Our website is CincinnatiUSA.com. It's the largest travel portal in the region. It's larger than that of a number of our neighboring cities that people would think of as perhaps an alternative to traveling to over Cincinnati. But we have a website that shows you all the excitement.
For Business Wise, I'm Tom Cooney. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney, and this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Linda Antis. Linda is the president and CEO of the Cincinnati USA Regional Tourism Network. And Linda, I bet you there's a couple of people that may not even know there is such a thing as a Cincinnati USA Regional Tourism Network. Give us a little background on just why your organization was formed.
The Regional Tourism Network is now starting our seventh year with the turn of the calendar. And we were formed for several reasons. First of all, if you think about our region and the 15 counties and the wonderful experiences that we have here, many, many people would probably like to be aware of the excitement they can have by traveling here and being a tourist. So it was formed so that the two convention bureaus in Hamilton County and the three counties in Northern Kentucky could really focus their attention on attracting new meetings and conventions. And so by sharing a portion of their bed tax revenue with us, we focus on the leisure traveler. If you think about it, the visitor doesn't perceive the river dividing us. They see it as an opportunity to be accessible between the north and south side of the river. So in forming it, what we did is we elevated our voice. We created a consistent way for people outside of our market to hear about the exciting things that they can do. And it has caused the business to grow, along with the focus that our convention bureaus have on meetings and conventions.
What are some of the things to look forward to in 2013?
You know, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't start with our league champion Reds, because this past year, 2012, was very successful. Whenever there's a powerful weekend matchup that the Reds have, oftentimes what we do is we leverage that together with the other exciting things that people can cause their trip to get a little bit longer, and they come and spend more time and more money. So we look forward to the Reds having an even more winning season this year and driving other people here for other exciting reasons. That's just one of the many things. And the fact that it's a 9-month professional sports franchise that has a great following in the 5-6 states that are around our area is a really powerful way for us to market.
There's a whole lot of new entertainment
Absolutely.
Venues near the stadium now that we didn't used to be able to have.
Look at the Banks. I mean, the fact that we're now ready to break ground on the second part of the Banks is very, very exciting. And then, of course, it's like the wonderful bookend to the Newport and Covington riverfront on the southern side of Cincinnati, USA. But yes, you're right. Right around the stadiums, we have great excitement. We also have a brand new Horseshoe Casino that will be opening up in early March. That's very exciting. And they will also be marketing so strongly to help people know, when you come here to enjoy the casino, look at all these other exciting things that you can do.
You also mentioned that there's a new stop on the Bourbon Trail coming soon, isn't there?
Yes, under construction for fall of this year, I believe that we're going to find some bourbon tasting opportunities in the Newport area. So yes, that is coming this year, and it's very exciting. The other parts of the region that are always favorite places are the North area with Kings Island, and then of course we have wonderful museums in downtown as well as throughout the region. And the peak season is when people will travel the most, but now now they're starting to understand we're a wonderful weekend getaway. If you want to come and be a foodie, if you want to come and just stroll the banks, they're finding that it's any time of the year. It's a great place to visit.
Well, downtown Cincinnati has become much more livelier on weekends as a result of all that.
Absolutely. Fountain Square, over the Rhine. We have so many wonderful hot spots, areas that people want to gather. They can really just hang out if they wish, but there's so many exciting experiences around it that you can enjoy.
Well, Linda, thank you for your time today, and thanks for promoting Cincinnati. If people want more information on some of the events, what's your website?
Our website is CincinnatiUSA.com. It's an asset for us to use as residents, but also share it with your friends and family out of town.
Well, thanks for listening to Business Wise. I'm Tom Cooney. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.